This episode was created with the support of Free FM, Hamilton, New Zealand's community access media organisation. Visit us at freefm.org.nz. This program is sponsored by New Zealand Bridge, sponsors of Grassroots Bridge across the nation.
Welcome to the Bridge Zone. You're at the table with Barry and Mariana. How many sleeps for me, Barry?
I think it's about 11.
11 more sleeps.
Nearly down to single figures.
Right. And talking about 11.
In London.
I will be.
They won't know what's hit them when you arrive.
Well, it's been torrential rain tonight, so I'm pleased that I'll be going to hot weather, that's for sure.
We could be recording the next show via London.
In a fortnight we will be. I've got a confession, the number 11.
What haven't you done?
Well, I know that we've been giving all these rules over the last fortnight.
Should have stood you in good stead for your tournament on the weekend.
We got up to rule 21 and a half, and I think out of all the boards that we played, I probably only used two, the rule of 20 and the rule of 11. I couldn't remember the rest of them. I'm wondering what a waste of time that was.
But you knew about the rule of 20 and the rule of 11 before you started.
I know. I couldn't remember any of them. It was just too much. I was thinking, now, what about those ones where you could normally open a week two? You could be two tricks short and one trick short.
A lot of us have been to different bridge seminars and, you know, they may go for a day or two or certainly a few hours. Yeah, I really think if you go to those things and you come away with even one thing, but say you come away with two things, you're not going to remember everything that you hear. And you might not even agree with everything you hear. I think if you come away with one or two things that you find useful and that you remember, you've done okay. But you did come away with one or two things. I wouldn't worry too much about it. If you go along and you're trying to improve your bridge, if you pick up one or two things, that's about as good as it gets.
One thing that we had agreed on with our partnership, and I was playing in a new partnership, listeners, that after we have suit agreement, we're doing first round controls, and that seemed to work. It worked twice for us, which was great. So that's a good thing.
So you've all got your bags packed and you're ready to go? And now you're going to play any bridge while you're in London?
Yep, I've got a game hooked up with Richard Stewart from Auckland, and he's going to be at Waterloo. We said that we'll catch up for a gossip and a game of bridge. So I've already got one organised.
Do you know where you're going to play?
No, I don't know. He said there are plenty of bridge clubs around Waterloo ways. That'll be awesome. And also the lady from Hong Kong that I met, Kath. So we're going to try and catch up. And her son plays for Singapore in the over 50s, and she's going there. So we said if we've got time, we could meet up and have a game there too.
Well, that'll be fun. I tell you what, a beer won't be cheap.
What do you mean?
Playing bridge in London. I reckon per session, you might have to take out a loan.
Can't quite remember what Matt said. They start late and finish early. They don't play too many boards or something like that.
Start late, finish early and charge plenty. It'd be my...
North Island Piers. Are you playing that?
I am playing the North Island Piers. Are you?
Nope. I've got too much to do.
I guess you have, and it goes all weekend. They've got a few less tables than the South Island Piers. I think it's something like 27 tables or something, 28 tables, which is still a good turnout. And they have still got a few days, I guess. Maybe they'll get to 30. Can't see them getting much past that.
Bailiff and Judge Julie took out the Matariki Open.
They did. They led most of the day and won by miles.
Awesome. That was good. How did you go? Did you find any new wrinkles that you have to iron out?
Oh, there were a couple of things that came up. We really have to do some work on our system, we've decided. We've been a bit slack, to be honest.
Oh, well, how do you know you have to do some work on your system?
Just that we know what we're doing.
That's a pretty good thing, though, to go back and have a rehash.
It is. It's not like you're going to necessarily do something new, but you just want to make sure you know what you're doing. My tip this week is along those lines for any partnership. So a lot of pairs these days play Michael Cubids. So one of a suit by the opponents, two no trump over courses. I've got 5-5 in the two lowest suits and whatever your agreed range is, say 10 to 15 points, something like that, whatever they agree. And people do talk about what they do. But what about when the opponents use them?
Oh, what do you do after it?
Yeah, who talks about that? So your partner opens one club and they bid two no trumps over it. They've taken up a heck of a lot of room, haven't they?
Yeah, they have.
And if you've got a few points, you know, what does everything mean?
Yeah. Well, what do you suggest in that scenario?
Well, I would suggest if you just support partners opening bid at the three level or at the lowest possible level, which will usually be at the three level, that it should show 6 to 9 points in support for partner's suit. Partner's suit's a minor. It probably should be 5-card support.
I see, yeah.
Clubs, it certainly should be. So I think supporting partner's suit at the three level should just show 6 to 9 in support. If you've got more than 6 to 9 points, what do you do then? So it goes 2 clubs. 1 club from them, 2 clubs from the opponents, showing 2 5-card suits, whatever they might be. 3 clubs from you, so 6 to 9 and 5 clubs. What do you do if you've got 10 plus points in clubs? I think you should Q-bid one of the opponent's suits.
Anyone?
Oh, you've got a choice, haven't you?
I know.
You should look at it that the opponents have helped you out here. They've given you a chance to show 6 to 9 points with support for partner's suit, and they've given you 2 Q-bids available, plus you're allowed to double as well. You've got a plethora of bids available to you.
Okay, so 1 club, 2 club, and you bid 2 hearts. That shows 10 plus?
I think it's 10 plus points and support for partner's seat.
What would be the difference if you bid 2 spades?
You know what I'm going to say, don't you? It's down to partnership. You're assuming that the 1 club, 2 clubs shows both majors. But there was a hand last week in the Swiss Pairs at Hamilton where we went 1 clubs, 2 clubs, and it actually showed the red suits.
Right.
Showed 5-5 in the red suits, diamonds and hearts. Whatever it is, you've still got 2 suits to ask and find out what 2 suits it shows. You've got 2 Q-bids available. I mean, I think the lowest suit should be support for partner's suit for no other reason than it gives you a bit more room. If you Q-bid their higher suit, what should that show?
Probably that you're stronger. You've still got support, but you're stronger.
You can't be stronger than 10 plus. I mean, 10 plus could be 20, couldn't it?
Could be.
So perhaps you could, I don't play this, but some people do. The qubit of the higher suit says you've got 10 plus points and you've got the fourth suit, the suit that's not been bid.
Okay.
It means if you bid the suit that's not been bid, say like in this example, it's spades. It's gone 1 club. They've overcalled 2 clubs showing diamonds and hearts. You could bid 2 diamonds to show support for clubs at 10 plus points. You could bid 2 hearts to say that you've got a good hand with spades, 5 plus maybe. And that means that you could bid 2 spades as showing some values but not forcing. I'm not saying that's the best way to play it. What I'm saying is I bet there's a lot of people listening that have never discussed with their partner what all those bids mean. We've still got double left.
Yeah, what would that be?
Well, I think perhaps it should be maybe you're interested in penalising at least one of their suits. Maybe you've got their suits. You don't think they can make 2 of their suits. If you've got 4 good hearts or 4 good diamonds, you might be sitting there ready to pounce. So maybe it should say, hey, partner, I'm interested in playing for penalties here. What do you think? You know how I like to see blood all over the carpet, don't you?
Yeah, I know. So that would put the opponents on the back foot, wouldn't they? Because then they'll be like, well, what does that mean? You can't really ask too much.
Well, yeah, they can. They're entitled to know everything. If they're in trouble, it's not going to help them.
No.
And at least you've communicated with your partner. Now, I really think that a lot of people probably haven't discussed what all the bids mean after that. I certainly haven't discussed it with a lot of people that I play with. That's not something that comes up. That 30-second discussion at the bar, you don't say, oh, by the way, what does a Q-bid of 2 hearts mean if they make a Michael's Q-bid? It's not the first thing you think of, is it?
No, you wouldn't. They'd just say the first bit.
They will play week 2s and Landy. Maybe you might talk about playing Michael's Q-bids, but I'll bet it's dollars to donuts that you haven't discussed what your defense is if the opponent's using Michael's Q-bid. Hey, maybe that's why people play them. They're so effective because nobody knows what they're doing over them.
Potentially.
But that's a bit of a long tip this week. Some of our listeners have probably turned the sound down about now. They've got sick of hearing about it because it's so complicated. It's better to talk about it now. It's too late once it happens to you at the table.
That's right. Hey, the Matariki, did they announce how much was raised on the weekend?
I had a pretty good
turnout overall.
74 years.
We had eight. How many were in the intermediate junior?
They had quite a good turnout as well.
24. How many was in the open?
74.
We had 8 and 24 times 2 8, times 35. 7,420.
They would have had to pay a director and they needed to score it and there would be a few other expenses, no doubt. Sounds like quite a lot of money raised.
Yeah, brilliant, hey? Any fundraised funds are good.
Yep, that's right.
Coming up next, we're heading off to the courthouse. Director, please. How can I help?
Judge Julie presiding.
G'day, Judge Julie.
G'day. Nice and cold?
Yep, good time for blankies.
I think Auckland's still above 10, so we're not panicking.
Righto, we've had the weather report. Let's move on.
Oh, you old stickler.
He's written to the farmer, eh?
Right, so this is a bit of an oldie bit of goodie, but it comes up every week, just about. If you hear something from the table next door, well, I don't know, the table from two doors away, or you hear something from the table next door, where you're getting the boards from, what do you do? And if it involves calling the director, which I have a funny feeling it might, what is likely to happen when the director gets there?
Well, for a start, sometimes the things you overhear don't appear to have much bearing in reality. So people are talking about other hands and they're talking about something that can't happen. Some of the conversations you hear about, they think Deep Finesse will bid to a contract, for example, are entirely fictitious and meaningless. But for all of that, yes, sometimes you do hear what's happening and you are getting the boards from them. When that happens, you should call the director to say that you have heard something and you are concerned about what will happen next. The director will say, play the hands. And if by any chance you do end up with a problem on a hand because you think it relates to what has been said at the previous table, you will call the director back. 99% of the time, we never ever get a call back because it becomes irrelevant. When we do get called back, it may well affect the person, but generally, if you feel like you've got to a point where your decision making is going to be based on the fact that somebody said something behind you, so you're in an invidious position about what you do or you don't do, then call the director back and the director will make a judgment about whether the play continues or whether it stops and you get an adjusted board. A lot of the time, nothing happens, but every now and then, you've heard that slams should be bidders, normally the most common thing.
Right, yeah.
The next most common thing that happens is no one can figure out what slam they're talking about because they can't see how it works on the hand. And as I said, every now and then you're sitting there and you do have a problem. You think, I know I want a bid slam, but is that because I heard them from behind me or is it because I actually have the information where I want to bid slam? And the most renowned example we had was at New Zealand Pairs Final. A pair overheard something a Kibitza said. And it affected the final placings of the New Zealand Pairs because they couldn't play that board.
Wow.
And if something hadn't been overheard, they may well have been able to bid for a contract that would have meant that they won. They called the director and the director made a ruling. And so I think they tied that year. I can't remember exactly the result, but it absolutely impacted on first place in the New Zealand Pairs because someone said something too loud that got heard.
It's always hard when we're sitting behind Barry, I must admit. He chats away like a choo-choo train.
Yes, I know. We played New Zealand Pairs final and they were in the semi-final and they're at the table near us and we said, please don't be going the same way we are because when they're your teammates and you're used to the sound of someone's voice, it is really hard not to hear it. I know Barry is really quietly spoken. So there's not much trouble for that. It's still really, really difficult.
You could have learned a lot.
Coulda, woulda, shoulda. And my recollection of that final is the one I don't want because we were appallingly bad.
See, it didn't do them any good hearing me, Mariana.
Well, maybe you weren't quite loud enough.
maybe he was.
No. Hey, while we're talking about interruption, on playing on real bridge, can you actually ask the director to ask a player to stop leaving the table?
When you're playing on real bridge, particularly in a tournament, you're meant to be playing like you're at the club. So at the club, you wouldn't be up and down like a bunny rabbit. I mean, smokers go out and come back in, but generally when they're dummy. So if someone is dummy, maybe they get up and move around a little bit. They would do that at the club. But in general, you're meant to start the table.
How often do bunny rabbits get up and down?
I've never done a survey. Okay.
Very good.
Thank you, Julie. Right.
Catch you next week.
Next week, we'll talk about myxomatosis.
Hey, look, I've been reading about funny bridge stories from Eddie Cantor. Have you ever met Eddie?
No. We tried to interview him once on the show. Do you recall? But he felt like he was getting on a bit and wasn't really, didn't think.
Oh, right. Well, one of the things that I read, this is quite a funny one. The story goes this way. A bridge teacher explaining duplicate bridge protocol tells this lady to make her opening lead face down. She promptly puts her head on the table and leads a card face up. How cute is that?
I just read that he actually died a couple of years ago at 89.
Oh, really? I remember when I first started playing bridge, the norm was that you told a joke if you won the tournament. That doesn't seem to be the case now.
Obviously, with these online ones, actually, when the Hamilton Club had one a while ago, we did actually try to basically arrange an interview with the winners.
Yes.
But it didn't work out so brilliantly. But I think it's something that could be done, but other clubs don't seem to do it. And so it gets a chance to tell a joke, even if they've got a good one.
That's why I was thinking about it. You know, when people win tournaments, they used to always come up with the bridge joke. And then it got to any joke.
That's true.
Yeah.
But I think it may happen again. Maybe we've run out of jokes.
I don't know. There's lots of humorous stories available. Do you have a favourite bridge joke?
No, I don't. None of the bridge jokes aren't that good, to be honest.
Put it this way, how many bridge jokes have you told over the span of your decades?
Jokes I've told haven't been bridge jokes.
I see. I'll tell you this one, and I think this one's okay. So there's two great players, Robert Sheehan and Jonathan Cancino. You heard of them?
I have.
Well, they had a terrible game one time. And, of course, each one thinks it's the other one's fault. Finally, Robert hands Jonathan a tiny piece of blank paper and says, "Here, Jonathan, write down everything you know about bridge." Jonathan replies, "Well, it's a bigger piece of paper than I would have given you." A lot of them relate to husband and wife, so I'm not going to tell one of those jokes. I don't want to put the kibosh on you.
Before you do that, I want you to have a guess at what Robert Sheehan's occupation was. You'll never guess it. He was an animal physiologist.
No way.
A computer systems analyst and a bookmaker.
What? Okay, what was Jonathan Cancino?
I haven't Googled Jonathan Cancino, but I just thought that was interesting.
Well, here you go, a little bit of Wikipedia for you listeners. Jonathan Cancino was the co-inventor of the bidding idea known as the multi-two-diamond convention. That's a pretty good thing to be known for. A lot of people use that.
Yeah, I don't think he did anything as interesting as being an animal physiologist or a bookmaker. Gosh, apparently at the age of 34, he underwent an operation for a brain tumor, which effectively put an end to what would undoubtedly have been an outstanding bridge career.
Oh, that was bad luck.
Such was his reputation that when the British team went up to receive the silver medal in the European Teams Championships in 1971, the chant went up from the audience, "Can see no, can see no, can see no."
Yeah.
Slightly to the chagrin of the other five members of the British team who felt they too had played a part.
Funny. Do you know what his occupation was?
I think he was probably just a professional bridge player. It doesn't say anything else that he did. He was born in 1939, died in 2006. That would have made him 67. It says from 1964, his partnership with John Collings became a byword for success, where they won every major tournament and internationally at the age of 25. So he didn't do too much else by the sounds.
So it's pretty funny if your partner gives you a little piece of paper, write down all you know about bridge.
G'day, it's Pete here, and today I wanted to talk about the quantitative 4-0 Trump bid. I think this is a fantastic tool that is either underutilized or some people just don't really know about it. So what I wanted to talk about is, what is quantitative 4-0 Trump? Why it's actually useful? Quantitative 4-0 Trump versus Blackwood? And to talk about a few different actual situations. So first of all, what is quant or quantitative 4-0 Trump? So let's have a look at an auction here. 1-0 Trump, pass 4-0 Trump. This would be an example of a quantitative 4-0 Trump bid. And basically, it's just a natural invite. Like, there's a lot of confusion about it, but basically, it's just natural. It's saying, do you want to go to 6-0 Trump? Or do you want to just leave it here in 4-0 Trump? Because the game level is at 3-0 Trump, we've bypassed that by one level. We're just using that to say, partner, do you have a bit extra for your range? Quant is extremely natural. It's really easy to play. The main hurdle that you actually have to get over is, when is it actually quantitative for no Trump, and when is it something else like Roman keycard? First of all, let's look at why quant is actually good. Most people think that when bidding slams, you need enough aces and then you can actually bid slams, but that's not really it. Roman keycard, when you use it, it's basically saying, I was just about to bid slam, but I need to find out if we have enough aces just in case that the opponents can cash too. If you didn't have Roman keycard, what you're saying is you were just going to be bidding slam. And that was like your final check before actually bidding it. But there are lots of times where you're like, well, I'm close to slam, but I need to know if partner's actually got a good hand for their range or not. You've got a few extra points, but you don't know whether your partner's minimum or their maximum. For instance, let's say partner opened one no trump in this sequence, playing 15 to 17, and you have 16 or 17 points. Let's say 16 points. If your partner's only got 15, you've only got 31 points, so you probably don't have enough gas in the tank to actually try and make slam. Whereas if partner's got 17 points, then yes, you do, and you'll have 33 points, and that's enough to want to actually be in slam. With quantitative for no trump, basically you're checking, do you have enough points to actually get there? And one thing you'll notice is if partner's maximum, and you're asking, do you have 33 combined points, is the general idea of it. If you do have 33 combined points, you aren't missing two aces. So if you're not missing two aces, why did you actually have to use Blackwood anyway? You use it to say, I'm checking if we have enough points to try and go for six no trumps or a slam. So what sort of hands should accept quantitative for no trumps are basically hands that are just maximum or have some extra values. So you use the for no trump bid to say, I've got an invitational hand to slam. So you look at whatever range you've actually shown so far and then think, am I minimum for my point range or maximum? And if I'm maximum, I should go. If I'm minimum, I just want to stop. There's a whole lot of other factors that you look for as well, such as, do I have a source of tricks? How good does my hand look for slam in general? Is it all queens and jacks, or do I have some other useful cards as well? So they're the sorts of things that you actually look for. On to the critical point. When is for no trumps quantitative and when is it Blackwood? Lots of pairs have some different rules about when it is, and some pairs play it one way and some the other way. I'm just going to go through what I like to do and a few different actual philosophies that I have around it. So first of all, after the final bid was no trumps, I tend to like for no trumps as quantitative. So here, whenever we've shown a balanced hand, so one no trump, four no trumps, two no trumps, four no trumps, if we open a suit and then rebid two no trumps and then jump to four no trumps, basically whenever no trumps was the final bid and then we bid four no over it, I like that just to be a quantitative four no trump. Another one is that after stamen and transfers, so this really depends on what your methods are, but let's look at a couple of auctions where we've bid stamen and then a few auctions where we've actually transferred. So let's say it's gone one no trump, we bid stamen and our partner bids two spades, and we have a 16 or 17 point hand with four hearts. We haven't found a fit, and if partner's minimum still, we don't want to be in slam. But if four no trumps is Roman keycard, then how do we actually invite slam in these spots? Well, I like four no trumps to be quantitative four no trump. And the reason being is there is actually a way that you can set your suit. My general rule that I use is if you can set the trump suit and you haven't instead, you're using quantitative four no trump. So if you have a simple way to set the trump suit, show that you're in a forcing auction, but choose not to do that, then you're saying you don't have a fit. And this is because I'm a huge advocate for Q-bidding towards slams and using the Q-bidding conventions, which means that if you can set the trump suit, you allow yourself to Q-bid. So if you don't do that, you basically don't have a fit. And if you don't have a fit, you want to use quantitative for no trump. So I would have this bid here as quantitative for no trump. The question is, how do you actually set the spade suit in slam trap? So after stamen, what you tend to do is bid the other major at the three level. So if partner responds two hearts, you can bid three spades. And if partner bids two spades, you can bid three hearts. And this says, I have a fit for you and I'm interested in slam. So it's a bit unusual, but it's quite useful when you think about it, because there's no reason why you'd want to be bidding hearts naturally here. You might have bid stamen and your partner says, I don't have hearts, and yet you're still bidding it. So you can use this as a completely artificial bid to say, partner, I have support for you. Please start Q-bidding, and we're in a slam trying auction. And this means that you can go through this way, find out about Q-bidding, and then move into keycard. Similarly, if partner bids two hearts, you don't really have any reason to jump to three spades here. So if you bid three spades, this says nothing about control in spades, just says I'm slam trying, we have a heart fit, please start Q-bidding. So notice that we have this way to set the trump suit after a stamen bid, which means that when we don't do that, but instead jump to four no trumps, this is actually quantitative and denies having a heart fit. Basically, a partner can either pass, or they could choose to bid six no trumps, for instance, or maybe even six spades if they had a spade fit in this particular instance. So quantitative is a bid that can be passed. I haven't mentioned that yet, but I think it's very important to say you can either pass four no trumps or you accept it and jump to six no trump if you're maximum, just like any other natural invite.
Peter returns next week with his thoughts on, after a transfer system, how to use quantitative four no trumps.
On the weekend, there was the Wellington Regional Teams.
Oh, yeah? What happened down there?
I'm only going to give you one guess what the name of the winning team was.
Oh, really? Was it the Weir team?
Yeah, absolutely. It was the Weir team. That was Michael Weir, Glenn Coutts, Scott Smith, and David Ackerley.
That's all right, isn't it?
The second team had a bit of a glitch. Hamilton Airport was fogged in on Saturday morning.
Yeah.
So Liz Fisher were due to fly out to get down there for the first match at 12. They were there at, I don't know, 7:30 or something in the morning, but they never flew out till 11:40.
Oh, yeah, it was a bit of a disaster, wasn't it?
So they arrived there too late to play the first match, and they also missed the first board of the second match. They got there, and their substitute stood up and let them take over. And Blair was telling me that he sat down and he said, oh, by the way, what did they do on the first board? The opponent said, oh, your substitutes played in six diamonds vulnerable down three. But we don't know how good it was. And Blair thought to himself, it doesn't sound very good.
Yeah.
Six diamonds down three.
Yeah.
Does not sound very good. Anyway, they continued to play the rest of the match, and when it came time to score up and they got to this board, Blair said, minus 300. And their teammate said, that's plus 14 imps. They were in six spades double making their way. You never can tell, Mariana. Sometimes minus 300 can be a very good score.
We've got some more gossip about the Fishers' trips to Wellington next week. Okay, everyone, we'll have a good week at the tables. We'll catch you next week.
Bye for now.
New Zealand Bridge, sponsoring bridge from beginner to international nationwide. This Free FM podcast was brought to you with support from New Zealand On Air.